for the evening's talk is, what is it that we really want? Some 2500 years ago, when Gautama Siddhartha, known as the Buddha, was walking in this area, a young man came to meet and talk with him and asked him about a life of awareness and inquiry and an investigative observation of one's existence and relationship to it. And the young man was obviously of a wealthy and influential background. And he told Gautama, he told the Buddha, that in his meetings with his parents before leaving his home, he had a conversation with his father. And as is traditional in this part of the world, and to some degree in the Western society as well, there was a strong emphasis from his father, an influential and wealthy businessman, for his son to take up the same line of work, to follow through and to keep the family business going as it has been going, as it had been going from one generation to the next. And there was this expectation. And the father had said to the son, well, look, we've been brought up, you've been born into this family, there's a reason for that, we've educated you, we've trained you. And then he said, and we also have this tradition here in this part of the world, in India, of what were described as the four stages of life. This is in the Brahminical tradition, Hindu tradition as we would call it in contemporary scholarship. And in that you came into a family, you got married and started a family, you became established, and then in the fourth stage of life, at the very end of one's life, then one would leave the background and home and become a wandering mendicant, enter into spirituality, into religious life. And so the father said to the son, look, why, you're only in your 20s, why don't you wait? Why not fulfill your obligations to family and to your society, and then in the latter period of your life, take up this religious thing? And the son said to his father, I remember reading when this was years ago when I was a monk, and the words struck me. The son said to his father, I have looked at this way of life that you and the family lead. I have looked at this way of life and all that goes with it, and all the expectations and all the pressures that go with it. And then the son said, I've looked at that way of life and I don't want to live my life like that. I don't want to live like that. And we see in our own society the enormous problems. One in six people in Western society will need to meet with a psychiatrist during the course of her or his life. At any given time, in a 14-day period in the West, 50% of the people are on some kind of medication. One in five people will contract cancer during the course of life. Tremendous pressures, stress, ill health, unhappiness within, I would almost say, a deteriorating social fabric. And so we may say, well, I want to step out of that. And perhaps we have to ask ourselves, and it's not easy to stand rather alone and independently in the world and rather fearlessly in that respect. And we have to stand back and perhaps we have to ask ourselves, firstly, in actual terms, what is it that I want? What is it that I want? sometimes when we ask ourselves that question, is it obviously it's an important, it's a profound question. What can easily arise for us is the ideal. I want to be, or whatever, but some kind of ideal which one has about oneself. And certainly in my experience, and possibly yours, we never seem to arrive at the ideal of how we would like to be. We never seem to be perfect. We would love to be perfect, but we don't feel we are perfect, and even worse, other people don't feel we are perfect either. And even if we weren't perfect for ourselves, it would just be so nice if other people thought we were perfect. So let me ask myself, well, what is it that I want? And to some degree, what are we going to base our response on? What's actually going to tell us, not in ideal terms, but in actual experiential terms, what is it that I want? And to some degree, the measure of that, the inner communication of what I want, is by what I think and what I imagine and by what I do. If I'm going to go just on experiential terms, I've got to go on what's happening for me in my life, what I am doing in my life, and how I think and feel and imagine about myself. Sometimes, and I'm not saying good, bad, right, wrong, should be, shouldn't be, but just in simple terms, sometimes I simply want more money. I feel I haven't got enough of it. There are other people who obviously have more than I do. I can tell by the quality of their sleeping bag. And I would like more than I have. And that feeling, that inner sense of absence of, the lack of, I don't know anybody who has had that absence of disappear through having more money. Anybody. So we start off with, as it were, something missing inside of ourselves, or the feeling about. And I'm not talking about the hardship and the poverty and the corruption and the tyranny and the way that people are dispossessed and deprived. I'm just speaking possibly, which concerns all of us. In that, in our situation, we may be experiencing feeling of, I don't have enough money. And we may come into money. There's plenty of people in what I would call my peers, my generation, whose parents have passed away, or grandparents, and have left money and so forth. There are other people here who work for money or borrow money. And it seems to me that one, no matter how much one keeps getting, it never fills that missing feeling of I don't have enough. And it's, and a very good example is surely in the city. You know, these poor people who work in the city, the money makers, the financiers, the speculators, who are no good to anybody, and least of all to themselves. And who are, and it's pathetic to see them still trying to make more money when they're knocking on death's door, riddled with misery and ill health and so forth, and still profiteering. You know, or others in religious figures who accumulate all these massive amounts of an empire building and flashy cars and all this, that and the other, all symbols of inner poverty. The Rolls Royces and the Cadillacs and the helicopters and all of that stuff. And when I said, well, what's my relationship to this area of life, of money? How much does it preoccupy me? How much does it really grab my attention? And of course you and I have to think about it, have to refer to it, have to use it, have to be use it wisely and intelligently. Do we have that kind of balanced relationship with it? You know, you know for yourself, and I have to look, and I have to look for myself. And sometimes it may not be money so much, but I think a strong preoccupation of mind these days is name and fame. And then we think of the ways that means that we can gain some kind of public popularity. What can we do that somehow or other will make other people sit up and take notice of who we are? And now, the way that one's going to work with that, look at that, is what's your fantasy life like? This is a wonderful clue. Because is this the actual what's going on? What's the fantasy life like? And I just noticed before I left England, you probably have it in other countries as well, unfortunately, is this dreadful book called the Guinness Book of Records. And it only proves what a bizarre species the human race is, in which there are people competing in the most crazy, unimaginative ways to gain public attention. And the whole book is full of these records, thousands of them. And sometimes this, when we experience this, then we feel, I'm nobody. I'm nobody special. I can't act, and I can't write a book, and I can't win the 100 meters, and I can't do this, and I can't... All these fantasy life theories that go through. And one says, well, I'm not like that. I'm just me. Nobody special. And it seems very difficult just to be who you are. And when we can't, the fantasy life comes in. Do you know, I was reading in the States, have you heard of this film actor? Those of you who were born a couple of lifetimes ago will remember him. His name's Kirk Douglas. He used to play kind of, macho detectives and cowboys and those things. So he was writing in a newspaper there that while driving along on some highway on the west coast of the States, there was a hitchhiker on the side of the road. And he stopped the car, and he let the guy into his car. And the guy, you know, just hitcher on the road, just turned to him and looked at him. And he said to Kirk Douglas, "Do you know who you are?" And it's this kind of, projection and preoccupation and the building up of somebody. And as a result of this, this build-up has gone on in a way which, in a way, I feel undermines ourselves. When you and I are positing and putting somebody up on a pedestal, in whatever area or category of life, in some way or other, to the degree that we do that, we make somebody special and we fix that person, to some degree, I think there's self-rejection going on. And I'm not sure if there's any way out of that, except by you looking at the pattern of mind and the image to project onto another and put somebody into the special category. And another area too, which, what is it when we ask ourselves, what is it that I want? How does that show itself in speech, in thought, in fantasy, in image? And sometimes what we want is somehow or other to stay young and healthy and full of energy and as it were, stay fixed in a certain age, in a certain category. And one of the things which one notices, to keep, as it were, the spirit alive in oneself, to really live with the spirit alive in oneself, one's got to be watching of the clinging and the holding on to what's gone by. One can spend an enormous amount of time looking in the mirror for what's not there. That we have a kind of fantasy or daydream with ourselves that somehow, if we ever had it, some of beauty or attractiveness or whatever it might be, that somehow or other we look for it in a certain way. And I would say this socially constantly undermines women and it undermines men right across the board. Anybody who looks in the mirror honestly may not, if they're using comparison, feel at all happy with what they see. Really. And now these, just a small thing in this, the magazines, these magazines that they publish, and you see a picture of somebody, it's a beautiful woman, beautiful woman's face, and one forgets in the looking at that, or that one of these male models the same, one forgets that what one is looking at is firstly the so-called cream of the milk. Somebody has picked out who's in the social time looks especially handsome or especially beautiful. Then comes along a very skillful photographer with a very expensive camera using the most strategically placed lighting, added to which there's all sorts of makeup and touching up here and etc., etc., with the most expensive clothes to model. You put all of that together. In that moment of time, you photograph it in soft, undulating colours to bring out the that. And then you look at that and you say, well, why aren't I like that? And now, to make it even worse, a friend was telling me recently, that to make it even worse, what is happening now is that they're picking on 14-year-olds and 13-year-olds and 12-year-olds and photographing that young person made up because their complexion, as one might expect, is that much more fresh and clear. So what chance have we got? So really this pursuit of wealth and pursuit of popularity and pursuit of beauty and all of that really doesn't contribute to our well-being. It's a mug's game, it's a fool's paradise. It's short-lived, and if it's there, we so easily with the past, we hold on to it, we cling to it, and all of that holding and clinging and wanting to be kills the spirit. One of the things which one notices too with that, in the way that it undermines ourselves, that in the aging process, and I was reminded this today, one of the Jack Kornfield, one of the meditation teachers, he uses from time to time a visualization, and a simple visualization of how we start off as very small and very, very vulnerable, as we are in fact through much of our life, and then one just visualizes one's human form through the various stages of our existence to wherever we may reach. And sometimes when one speaks with people who may be quite a few years older than ourselves, who are 60s or 70s and further, that one of the things which is commonly reported is that outwardly one does look quite different from one's younger years. So different one isn't even recognizable. But inwardly, in one's heart, in one's spirit, in one's thought, in one's feeling about life, one feels just the same. And it's as though that sometimes one looks at the body and says, well, you know, here it is. And yet inwardly, as some of our parents would say, I'm 65, I'm 70, and I feel like inwardly just like I was when I was 21. And then the person says, will say, and follow up would say, and where did those years go? Where do the years go in life? Like, as the Buddha used to say, like a spark out of the fire. And so we, as it were, faced with and meet these situations in life, still the question, what is it that we want? And from that, perhaps, it's very essential and very necessary here for us in our meditations, in our being together, to listen very carefully. And I would say, in that listening to ourselves very carefully and connecting with ourselves, that quite frequently the response is, and the immediate response is, actually, I don't know. I really don't know what I want from life. And in that, I feel there's a precious opportunity. Can I just stay in touch with my experience, if that is the response that one is experiencing, of really not knowing? I really don't know what I want. And when one is in really not knowing, then one's going to have to rely and somehow trust, not so much in what other people tell you, this is what you want and this is what you should get and this is what you should go after. One's going to have to rely on some kind of mystery or unnamed wisdom and trust that something will come through if I allow myself to experience not knowing what I want. See, because my sense is, and I don't know if you agree, but my sense is the socially conditioned wants, profit, power, success, privilege, status, popularity, being somebody, in those social terms. My feeling is that that kind of wanting in life comes because the person doesn't really know what they want. Deep down, the person, understandably, hasn't been able to stay with not knowing. Hasn't been able to see, well, let's see what comes through the being. And not being patient, and not even perhaps even thinking that way, then the socially conditioned wants come about. Though, like those I just mentioned. So how are we going to stay in part of the meditation processes? How are we going to stay in touch with ourselves and see? One of the difficulties which you experience, and frequently enough sitting in the meditation hall, is what we describe as the unpleasant sensation. And one might ask, you might ask yourself, during today, what has been the most difficult event? What's been the most difficult experience, actuality, for me today? What's gone, which has been clearly and obviously perhaps standing out as a particular or in a general way, which has felt decidedly painful and unpleasant, unsatisfactory? What experience? Sometimes emotion, thought, bodily, whatever. Now one knows that, you know, sees that when one has grasped onto some very difficult, unpleasant experience, frequently the thought which goes with it is either this is never going to go away, or I'm going to have to go away. Either reaction of resistance and intolerance towards, or I must get away from. And sometimes when you're especially here in the meditation room, when you're sitting, and you've been sitting for half an hour, 35 minutes, for eternity, and you're praying, you didn't think you could pray, but you learned this on Vipassana retreats, you're praying for the end of the meditation. Never mind saving the world, what about my legs? And so, in those moments, all that one wants is to hear this. Nothing else really matters. I don't care about profit and money and success and being an international celebrity. Just give me this. And then, in that period of time, in waiting for liberation after 45 minutes, all sorts of feelings, resistance, pains, fears can start arising in the body, in the mind. And sometimes, when that gets going inside of oneself, very easily the feeling or the view or perception that this is how I am, this is that I'm stuck with this, and sometimes all kind of fears of being paralyzed in a cross-legged posture, never being able to get out of it. And then the imagination, from the unpleasant sensation, put it with the fear, and in the imagination really has an opportunity to get underway. And I think, oh God, I'm trapped, my leg, I'll never be able to move it again. Then the imagination comes in, wheelchair. a specially constructed wheelchair, only for meditators, who sit cross-legged. And this, so one goes from bare event, bare sensation, to reaction, to imagination, and the whole process, so to speak, of all three gets locked in together. And one might say, if one looks optimistically, one might say, with that pain and with the struggle, well, finally, one is one-pointed. One has really got some concentration now. The mind is so concentrated, it can't space out on the birds and the flowers and sex and other people. And they say, all it can do is totally concentrated. So one ought to be happy. One says, I've come here, I've just done a course in Copan, I can't concentrate my mind, I'll come here, I'm going to learn some concentration, that would be very good. So now one is really concentrated because the mind can't move, it's trapped in its concentration. Never happy. No peace. So we ask ourselves, we check in with ourselves, what is it that I want? What is it I want from actually being here for 10 days? 8 days. And to see, perhaps the sense that the way we think about what we're doing is really significant. I was just speaking with someone who's a student of Kalu Rinpoche, who's one of the senior in age and experience, senior Tibetan lamas, who's in his 80s and staying up nearby. And I think it's today that there is some ordination taking place, and a number of people, both Westerners and Tibetans, are going into a retreat. And of course, retreat, whatever, leader all for such activities, and they are going in not for 10 days, not for 10 weeks, they're going in for 3 years. They're going into the retreat for 3 years. And there are a number who have done 3 years retreat. I think sometimes they say 3 years, 3 months, three days. And we know of one friend in upstate New York who has been in retreat for 1 3-year session. He's come out and he's now gone back in for 12 years. So sometimes, you know, think about it, 8 days. And in a way, it's with what's occurring in the body, with what's occurring in terms of yesterday, today, tomorrow, the day after, the sixth day, the eighth day, the tenth day. Just, 8 days to go. It's just 8 days to go. It's the thought has or is emerging in the present. But when it's 8 days to go, God, there's a whole other reaction taking place. And sometimes with these things we lose a simple perspective. And then in that we invest in the words 9 days to go, 8 days to go, 7 days to go, or whatever it might be. And we make something of it. And if it seems like it's long, we resist it. So the way we think about, the way we view what's happening influences our well-being. Sometimes the question of, well, what is it that I really want? Really isn't arising. And one can say, and it may be temporarily, one can say, well, right now, at this point, that it means today, this evening, this moment, right now, in fact, there is nothing that I want. I'm not saying whoever I am, I'm not saying I am full, I am complete, I am enlightened, I am this, I am that. But one might say, right now, there is really nothing that I want. And I wonder if we can give ourselves the space, if we can allow ourselves just to be familiar and comfortable and clear about the fact, right now, there is nothing that I want. Because if we can allow ourselves that familiarity, just sitting here, just being together, just being with oneself, it's okay. I'm not really looking for anything else more right now in my life. It's okay for us just to be here in this situation, in this particular spot on earth. And it seems to me that if you and I can allow ourselves just to experience the okayness of not wanting anything, what that contributes to immediately is when I want something, I'll know that I want something. I'll see, I'll be quite clear, this movement is taking place. I'll know that sensation, that movement, and I'll know what it's towards, and I'll know, and if I'm clear, I'll know whether I want to follow it through or let it go. So just sitting and not wanting anything, just walking and not wanting anything, deepens in a wonderful way the receptivity of our being to know when I want something. I really know when I want something, and I'll know whether it's just an old conditioned pattern. I'll know whether it's useful and creative and beneficial. I'll see clearly if it's just of no use and something just to let go of. And my sense and hope here is that there are moments, and there are perhaps many moments in the course of our day when you and I really are not wanting anything. That we really are okay with being who we are, what we are, where we are, how we are. I don't think that experience is so rare and so unusual, and it comes just once in a lifetime. But I would not finish there. I would still say in life, no matter how liberating and clear one is, that is enough for any human being. I would not say it's enough for you and I to be clear about not wanting anything and the spaciousness and the expansiveness of that, and to be clear about the movement of wanting. Because there is another question which must accompany that. And it contributes to balancing of that. And it's not only what is it that I really want, but the other in our interdependent life, what is it that I have to give? And sometimes we, in our socially conditioned mode of mind, we forget what it is we have to offer, what it is we have to give. It seems to me that spiritual life, or a life of awareness, is a life which we know what we need, we know what we don't need, and we know and see clearly what we have to give. And that movement, that coming and going, that giving and receiving, that abiding between the two, there in that there can be a very loving understanding. But we won't start off too ambitiously. We'll just be aware, as many opportunities as we can, of what it is that we want. What kind of thought accompanies that? If there's a kind of reaction that goes with that, what kind of form that takes? And viewing that process, viewing that activity, if we can, with some degree of interest. Look at this phenomena going on. Once again, I want more chapatis. Once again, I want to stay in bed longer than 5:15 in the morning, as it will be tomorrow morning. Whatever. And all sorts of things we can forget in those times. You know, just be grateful you're not sitting a Zen retreat. You know, 5:15, Zen masters would think we're all on holiday here. You know, they kick off at 3:30 in the morning. So, always in our relation, always relative. But let's in, whether in our moments, in our sitting, in our walking, or in our eating, or when we're lying down to go to sleep, also to be aware of those precious moments when we're not looking for anything in life. We have no expectations, no demands on ourselves or on life. None whatsoever. Just experience the exquisiteness of that moment. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings be in touch with life. May all beings live with love. So let's have a couple of minutes quiet period, shall we, together?